Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
The episode you're about to hear was recorded in early June 2020, a time marked by a constellation of crises. First, the global pandemic of COVID-19, which, among other things, has killed hundreds of thousands of people, disrupted the daily lives of billions, and exposed cruel inequities in societies around the world. Second, yet another wave of horrific violence against Black communities and Black bodies, including George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Tony McDade, and too many more to name, in the United States has unleashed a torrent of protests demanding a modicum of justice in the face of pervasive and systemic racism. Finally, and relevant to the conversation that will follow, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu won re-election and has pledged to annex the West Bank, formalizing a decades-long process of brutal military occupation. His announcement came as a surprise only to those who have routinely ignored Palestinians, who have loudly and repeatedly sounded the alarm to anyone who would listen. In the United States and many other countries around the world, June is also Pride Month. Born out of a riot led largely by trans women of color at New York City's Stonewall Inn in 1969, Pride is both a celebration of one's identity and a protest against forces that would seek to extinguish the LGBTQ community, punishing difference as dangerous deviance. Without spoiling too much, our guest today ends his book by imagining a liberating queer politics, one that can speak out against discrimination and oppression against LGBTQ people, while also leveling powerful critiques against racism, sexism, state violence, imperialism, and military occupation. As Professor Achan's book and our conversation about it shows, this work is tremendously difficult and fraught, but it is also urgent. Normally, Pride Month is replete with parades and festivities, both freeing and in some ways problematic. With COVID-19, however, public concerns necessitate that Pride will look different this year. But it is my hope that these tremendously difficult times will spur us both to action and deeper contemplation. LGBTQ people and our allies, Palestinians and their allies, Black Americans and their allies. How can we work toward a politics that disrupts the status quo and puts us all on a path toward greater emancipation? How can we stand in solidarity with people who are different than us, holding their concerns as dearly as we each hold our own concerns? I certainly don't have all the answers, and Professor Achan will acknowledge that his book doesn't either. But I hope that as you listen to our conversation and read Saad's book, it will spark more conversations about how we can move forward together. Black lives matter. Queer lives matter. Palestinian lives matter. Thanks so much for tuning in. Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Middle East Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Joshua Donovan, and today I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Saad Achan to the show. Dr. Achan is an assistant professor of peace and conflict studies at Swarthmore College. Previously, he was a postdoctoral fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International Studies. An anthropologist by training, Professor Atchan is the author and co-author of a number of works dealing with Palestinian society and politics, global LGBTQ movements, and Quaker studies. His recent publications include a co-authored volume entitled The Moral Triangle, Germans, Israelis, and Palestinians, published this year from Duke. And he has a forthcoming book, Paradoxes of Humanitarianism, The Social Life of Aid in the Palestinian Territories. But today we're going to talk about his new book, Queer Palestine and the Empire of Critique, out this year with Stanford University Press. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Atchan.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the way that we like to start these is to just give you an opportunity to briefly introduce yourself. And could you tell our listeners how you came to write this book?
Yes, absolutely. So I basically am an educator, a scholar. I'm a professor at Swarthmore College outside of Philadelphia in the Peace and Conflict Studies program. And I'm also Palestinian. I grew up in Palestine. I myself am gay, and also an LGBTQ human rights activist. And so the issues that I explore in this book on the LGBTQ Palestinian movement are near and dear to my heart and very much intimately connected to my own personal experiences and activism and scholarship.
Thank you. So you explain in the book that this is at least in part an autoethnography. So what do you mean by this, and why did you settle on this approach?
Well, you know, I think that all scholarship to some extent is autobiographical. I think that if you really press scholars in terms of their research interests, I'd argue even in the most quote unquote objectively rational field, even in the STEM field, there's always a trace of someone's history and positionality that informs their passion and their drive and their commitment to a particular intellectual endeavor. And so I think that all of us are engaging in autoethnographic work to some extent. But in my case, I explicitly sort of center the text and the methodology within an anthropological history of autoethnographic work, which is quite common in my field of study. And I did this knowing very well that there is in the academy a critique of what's called me-search. So this idea of studying oneself, one's positionality reflexively, even though anthropologists have embraced this to a large extent, there are other fields that are skeptical. There are scholars that can be skeptical of this kind of work, especially when you have subaltern populations, women, people of color, LGBTQ populations, religious minorities, etc., engaging in research agendas to help give voice to the voiceless, to help explicate dynamics, whether social or political, at the margin of the margin, at the periphery of the periphery. But then they risk being accused of engaging in what's called me-search, this idea that one is just simply engaging in a kind of narcissistic exercise and this kind of grievance politics. And I think that in some cases, people can go a little bit too far in that extreme. But I think what that notion of me-search does is it erases the fact that actually hegemonic scholarship historically and in the contemporary context has very much been me-search. And when white scholars study white norms and white institutions and white intellectual thought and European and American hegemonic frames of references, this is the default. It becomes the norm. Again, it's hegemonic. So it's invisible as a kind of me search. So they are doing objective, rational research. But the rest of us are merely engaging in me search, or so this criticism says. So I knew going into this project that I was doing something quite sensitive and that is mired in these considerations, but I felt it was very important to proceed nonetheless in a rigorous and analytically sound manner.
I appreciate both hearing now and having read in the book as well your how upfront you were about this and about striking a balance between, on the one hand, writing about a community and particularly activist community that you are personally involved in, while also bringing in the scholarly rigor that one would expect to see in a book from Stanford University Press. And so talking about this in the United States, of course, here we are in June, which kicks off the American Pride Month, right, or Pride in the United States. And there are some similarities, but also, of course, a lot of differences between LGBTQ movements in the United States and in Palestine. Some of our listeners may be familiar with the LGBTQ movement in the United States, but maybe less so in Palestine. So could you briefly just kind of sketch out what the movement is like in Palestine? Who are some of the major organizations and players, just to give us a frame of reference?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the LGBTQ social movement in Palestine is about 15 years old now. It's a relatively young movement, and it has been largely led and spearheaded by queer Palestinian women, feminists. They have played a disproportionate role in leading and catalyzing and sustaining the movement. Although obviously people who identify as men also see themselves as part of the movement as well. And there are two major LGBTQ Palestinian organizations. One is called Al-Qaws, which is short for rainbow in Arabic, and the other is called Aswat, which means voices in Arabic. But one of the main points I make in the book is that the Palestinian queer social movement cannot be understood simply by looking at institutionalized, formalized, professionalized NGOs alone, but that many, many people, in fact, most people who are contributing to the movement are doing so in an underground capacity, an individual or private capacity, as residents of historic Palestine, and as people who are shaping their familial dynamics, neighborhood dynamics, social, societal, communal dynamics in their own ways, and are not always necessarily attached to a particular ideological agenda that is put forward by the two major NGOs. So it's a heterogeneous movement, and queer Palestinians come in all shapes and sizes, many different parts of the political spectrum. And one of the things I try to do really in the book is to honor that heterogeneity and to push back at notions that there's an archetypical or authentic queer Palestinian political subjectivity, but that actually there are a myriad of queer Palestinian voices and subjectivities that all deserve to be heard and to be honored.
Thank you for that. It's, I think, an excellent point, and one, again, that appears throughout the book. One of the things that you discuss is not only the ontological diversity among LGBTQ people in Palestine, different queer subjectivities, but also an epistemological diversity, right, with different sets of metaphors and ways to understand and articulate experiences and aspirations, right? So one famous metaphor, for example, in the United States is this notion of coming out of the closet, right? And sort of publicly professing one's sexuality or sort of status as an LGBTQ person. What are some of the different epistemologies or metaphors that one sees in the LGBTQ community in Palestine?
Yeah, so sometimes there's this notion that, Western queer epistemologies are not relevant to queer epistemologies in contexts like the Middle East or Palestine in particular. And one of the arguments I'm trying to make is that actually, again, there's heterogeneity in queer Palestinian epistemologies as well, ways of making meaning, seeing oneself in the world, articulating one's struggle, one's vision for the future, finding language in order to have that sense of self. And there are notions or metaphors or discourses or epistemologies that emerged in Western contexts that actually resonate very deeply for many queer Palestinians in Palestine today. So, for example, the notion of the closet, right? In Arabic, we'll say khazane, and more queer Palestinians are integrating this metaphor of the khazane, literally in Arabic, into their everyday language. But then there are also many queer Palestinians for whom that notion doesn't resonate at all in any way. And so people, for example, will talk about rather than coming out, inviting in, or they'll talk about, you know, rather than coming out, actually it's a dance. You're constantly dancing throughout your life. You're maneuvering your way strategically, carefully through this kind of repertoire. You're building trust and you're coming out strategically to certain people. But then you may be, you know, protecting your this the knowledge of your sexuality from other people in contexts where that could be very, very dangerous. But also this notion that the closet as a temporal space, but also as a physical space, most queer Palestinians don't believe that you were in the closet physically and now you're out of the closet geographically. You're in this totally new spatial domain, or temporally that, you know, that was the past, you were in the closet, and now in the future, you're no longer in the closet. Actually, both spatially and temporally, one is constantly going in and out of the closet in strategic ways on a micro level, even multiple times per day. So I found there to be quite rich and compelling and beautiful epistemological frameworks that queer Palestinians are engaged in that I tried to highlight in the text.
So one of the other things that you highlight in the text, and in fact, I think in a certain way, it motivates a lot of the book is a series of obstacles, right, that the LGBTQ community, both activists and not activists, face in the context of Palestine. And, you know, for those interested in these issues, the book tackles a lot of course, deeply controversial issues. And so we'll get into one of them just to start. And that is how you discuss homophobia within Palestinian society without contributing to dehumanizing discourses, right? For example, I mean, as a gay man in the United States, I feel pretty comfortable speaking out against homophobia that I face in the United States because it doesn't contribute very often to broader dehumanizing discourses. There can be some other problems, but it doesn't excuse occupation, for example, right? So how are homophobia and occupation linked in your mind?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So, and it's a fraught question, and it's a challenging one. And I, you know, do try to be as thoughtful and nuanced as possible in explicating my argument. So I draw upon Audre Lorde's notion that there's no hierarchy of oppressions. And one cannot prioritize the struggle against Israeli military occupation or imperialism, settler colonialism, etc., over the struggle against homophobia within Palestinian society. That actually there are different forms of oppression that are external to our society, but there are also internal systems of oppression within our society. And the struggles are inextricably linked, and we can't disaggregate them. The queer Palestinian subject is simultaneously having to navigate toxic masculinity, homophobia within their society, as well as Israeli occupation, settler colonialism. And those two forces are seemingly disparate, but they actually reinforce one another in very powerful ways. But I think that we have to have an honest discussion about, in the academic community and outside of the academic community, about homophobia in Middle Eastern contexts. And I found that there's a dearth of queer scholarship in Middle Eastern studies that actually truly addresses homophobia in a real and honest and ethnographically sound way. There's no way we can escape the fact that survey data after survey data shows that 94 to 95% of Palestinian respondents have disfavorable views when it comes to homosexuality, right? That this is one of the highest rates of homophobia in the world. We have to grapple with this empirical reality and the way that it touches the lives of so many queer and trans and gender non-conforming people within Palestinian society. But we have to do so in a way that historicizes and contextualizes that homophobia, while at the same time, as you said, does not dehumanize or pathologize on a collective level Palestinian society writ large, and doesn't feed into colonial narratives that try to justify the oppression and subjugation of Palestinians. And I believe that we are able to do that and to strike that balance in ways that are quite productive and constructive if done ethically and sensitively and very, very carefully.
So one of the discourses that one runs the risk of bolstering, right, in discussing homophobia in Palestinian society is known sort of colloquially as pinkwashing, right? And to just briefly and poorly explain it for our listeners, pinkwashing is, you know, a discourse that highlights or argues for, progressive Israeli values when it comes to LGBTQ people, and manifests itself, right, in sometimes very physical, very very specific displays or overt displays, like the Pride Parade in Tel Aviv, for example. And opposition to that has grown up in the Palestinian LGBTQ movement, and that's often known as pink watching, right, or criticizing the sort of tokenization of LGBTQ people and essentially erasing or ignoring or distracting from the brutalities of occupation. But you argue, after sort of laying these debates out in a much more eloquent way than I did, that these debates have become sort of paralyzing and hegemonic. Could you explain that for us?
Absolutely, yes. So I am not an apologist for pinkwashing by any stretch of the imagination. And anyone who reads the book will see that I actually go in depth into defining pinkwashing, providing examples of pinkwashing, and really demonstrating unequivocally that the Israeli state has very cynically appropriated queer bodies and discourses and drawn attention to a purported advanced LGBTQ rights record in Israel, precisely in order to detract attention away from gross violations of Palestinian human rights. And that is extremely important to establish. And it is very important to recognize that so much of the transnational nature of the queer Palestinian movement and the bonds and ties and networks of solidarity that queer Palestinian activists have forged with other queer social movements around the world has been a response to pinkwashing in the form of pinkwatching. So all of that is, you know, I have to make sure is very, very clear. That being said, I do also draw attention to some queer Palestinian voices who are concerned that sometimes there's a tendency to see pinkwashing in everything. Sometimes it can be simplistic to reduce everything to pinkwashing. We've gotten to a point, for example, where any film that has any kind of queer representation of Israelis or Palestinians will be met with a knee-jerk response that it is engaging in pinkwashing. And also we get into this very problematic notion that any kind of public recognition of homophobia within Palestinian society is necessarily a form of pinkwashing because it's contributing to a civilizational discourse that is oppressing Palestinians even further, which, as we talked about earlier, in many, many cases is not the case. But also another example is that we can't recognize any advancements or achievements in terms of LGBTQ rights within Israeli society without then being accused of furthering a pinkwashing agenda. And it's gotten so bad that some of the radical purists, that's a term I use to describe some folks in the movement who move so far to the left that they're actually sometimes even mirroring the right and are practicing forms of ideological policing and excommunication that are very counterproductive and are inhibiting the growth of the movement. But now there's this new discourse emerging of quote-unquote internalized pinkwashing. So this idea that if a queer Palestinian wants to actually talk about homophobia that they've experienced, or if, for example, a queer Palestinian citizen of Israel wants to talk about the sort of nexus between queer Palestinian and queer Israeli civil society, then all of a sudden they risk being accused of having internalized a pinkwashing discourse and contributing to their own dehumanization. And that's very, very disheartening to see queer Palestinians come under this kind of what I call also discursive disenfranchisement, where they're very right to have tools, to language, to self-definition, to articulating their struggle is under assault. And it's not only under assault from the right, but it's also under assault from many parts of the political spectrum. And so one of my main arguments is that the critique of imperialism has become an empire of critique, and hence the title of the book. And that the queer Palestinian subject is now mired or trapped in these different forms of policing and surveillance at the discursive and material and embodied level from so many different forces near and far that can be quite debilitating. And in the end of the book, I try to articulate a vision for how we can overcome this impasse and truly move forward and transcend it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So one of the forms of opposing pinkwashing, but it's also a site of this sort of paralyzing critique that you're talking about, or paralyzing series of critiques, is boycotts, right? And specifically boycotts and awareness raising campaigns over pinkwashing in global queer spaces, right? So not just Tel Aviv, but there were incidents you talked about in New York City, in Chicago, in Seattle. Tensions emerge, you argue, when certain voices, be it Palestinian or Israeli, are excluded from queer spaces. You draw on Andrew Robinson's notion of monoglossia, right? And you argue that can hurt both the fight against homophobia and occupation. So how have some of these fights played out in the past, and how can we try to move toward a diaglossia or heteroglossia in which multiple discourses can sort of coexist within the queer movement?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, I'm interested as a queer Palestinian and also as a member of the social movement and as someone who cares deeply about it and its future trajectory, I'm interested in seeing it continue to grow. And I'm interested in seeing it succeed on multiple fronts. And I believe very strongly that in order to do so, we have to have as broad and inclusive of an ideological umbrella as possible. And we have to embrace many different queer Palestinian voices and strategies. And we have to refrain from some of the ideological policing and some of the dynamics that you've just synthesized as well, where we end up in a situation in which the only people who are sort of left as spokespeople and the only people who are left shaping strategy are people who have a very, very narrow and rigid and very particular ideological agenda, which has its advantages in many, many ways, but doesn't represent the full range of points of view. And I think that by democratizing the movement and by truly, truly accepting different articulations of struggle and different approaches to the struggle, that would allow the movement, I think, to be even more successful in the long run, and also to be able to nurture more, you know, stronger partnerships with external actors who are in solidarity with queer Palestinians. But now, unfortunately, the movement is really, really stuck because it's gotten to a point that it's effectively driven out anyone who does not subscribe to this radical purist politics. And that's been so disorienting for so many queer Palestinians, especially in historic Palestine, who didn't expect to experience abandonment or public chastising or public criticism from fellow activists and fellow people within the movement. And it's disheartening when activists turn against each other and when people within a movement turn against each other, especially publicly. But I think this is not unique to the queer Palestinian movement. And one of the arguments I make is that actually we see this dynamic in so many progressive and leftist movements all around the world, where sometimes we are so invested in policing one another that we really lose sight of the larger struggle and what lies ahead. And I think that more and more scholars of social movements, as well as activists, are actually talking about some of these toxic dynamics in these social movement spaces, and the fact that we really need to transform these social movement spaces into spaces of healing for people who are wounded and people who are vulnerable, and that we need to not perpetuate harm against one another, especially given all the other harm that we face.
I, you know, when I was reading this and just hearing you say it, the expression "the left eats its own" sort of comes to my mind. Something, of course, that applies to a lot of leftist movements in the United States, but I think, as you show here, it's also applicable to the LGBTQ community. One of the things I want to then turn to, because you do in your book, is the field of cultural production. You examine, on the one hand, journalistic representations and then also film representations of LGBTQ Palestinians, both by people from the region and not. How has the empire of critique stifled Palestinian voices in these areas?
Yeah, I mean, I give the example of a queer Palestinian film called Oriented, which was produced by a British filmmaker, but highlights the voices of three gay Palestinian citizens of Israel who live in Tel Aviv in the context of the 2004 Israeli military assault on Gaza. And there's very, very little editorializing. So we, over the course of the documentary, we really see the lives and experiences of these three friends, and we see the kinds of struggles that they face. At some point, they even refer to where they are positioned as Palestine. You know, they're in Tel Aviv, in what is now considered Israel. But for many Palestinians, I mean, all of this is part of historic Palestine. So they have a palpably strong sense of their Palestinian identity, of involvement in a kind of national struggle. But they also recognize their struggle as queer people within Palestinian society. You see one of them really struggling with his family to accept him, etc. So it's a very nuanced documentary. And it's one example that I give among a number of examples. But then all of a sudden, we see that the largest LGBTQ Palestinian organization issues a press release, really lambasting the film and lambasting these three individuals who agreed to be featured in it, accusing them of being complicit in pinkwashing. And then I give the example of inviting Khadir Abu Saif, who was one of the three protagonists, to speak at my home institution in a public forum after screening of the film. And then this very, very zealous non-Palestinian who is part of the Global Queer Palestinian Solidarity Movement, who marshaled that press release from Al-Quds and insisted that the film had to be boycotted because it's problematic, it's pinkwashing, we have to shut down the whole event. And I just asked him if he had considered the fact that he was lobbying a queer Palestinian who invited a queer Palestinian who has a film about him and his friends to cancel a film screening because the representation of the community or these particular individuals was not aligned with the ideological prism that this person in solidarity outside of Palestine had in their own mind about what is authentic and what is not, what is a proper queer Palestinian subject and what is not. And so I give this example as to show how you know, frustrating it is that we've gotten to this moment where people in Palestine, outside of Palestine, really have authorized themselves as the arbiters of authenticity and the arbiters of wokeness and the arbiters of what's acceptable discourse, what's acceptable cultural representation. And I make quite an impassioned plea for us to stop. and I say that, you know what, if there's a film that you don't like, you know, don't try to cancel it and cancel engaging in this cancel culture of everyone who's involved in it. Go produce your own or go support the production of another one. What the public sphere needs is not the shrinking of public discourse, but the expansion of public discourse. No film, no press release, no individual voice, no book, even my book, can provide a comprehensive, mosaic that needs to be explicated. It's only through a multiplicity of data points that we can finally get at that full picture, if we can even ever get at a truly full picture of a movement or a community or a population like this. So I really hope that the book will be read and that it will sort of spark some introspection within the movement and outside of the movement so that we can overcome some of these dynamics.
So one of the other areas that you argue is causing a number of problems, and no offense to our listeners who are part, as we are, of academia, but it is of the academy and most especially the Western academy. You take on two really influential ideas in queer studies, or at least global queer studies, and so I want to just, you know, have you sketch out your critiques of them. But the first is Joseph Massad's notion of the gay international. The second is Jesper Poir's notion of homonationalism, specifically as it was articulated in a couple of articles co-authored by Maya Makdashi. So could you outline some of the issues with these academic critiques?
Yeah, so I think that Western-based scholars who turn their academic gaze onto vulnerable populations, especially in the global South, or onto social movements that are, you know, facing tremendous odds, for example, like the queer movement in Palestine, there is an ethical responsibility to how it is that we engage in our knowledge production, in our academic critiques. And I do think that we have positive examples of that form of engagement, and I do reference, for example, in the book, the legacies that scholar activists such as Judith Butler or Angela Davis or, for example, Sarah Schulman at CUNY, who they've been invaluable, I think, to the global queer Palestinian movement, and as I say, have really poured their hearts and souls and provide us with such a laudatory example. But I do think that Western-based academic scholarship or public discourse and its critique, and sometimes its fetishization of critique, does have the potential to be debilitating for the social movements that it turns to. And so, you know, this idea of the gay international, but also this idea of homonationalism as it's been applied to the movement, have been profoundly devastating to this movement. And I hope that I've done a good job in my chapter on academia in really demonstrating with evidence precisely how debilitating those frameworks have been in terms of their reception and in terms of their effects, actual effects on these movements. I mean, most academic knowledge production, scholarship, public discourse has very little bearing, often in many cases, on what it's examining. But then you do have these cases, especially when folks are as influential as you mentioned, that really can be, it's disheartening to see what that does. And so this idea that with the gay international, this idea that a movement that sees itself primarily as an anti-imperialist movement, and I would argue actually has prioritized the struggle against imperialism over the struggle against homophobia, which is raises a whole other set of issues. For that movement to be accused of being mired in imperialist dynamics and complicit in Western sexual imperialism and these imperialist agendas, what it does is it just further stigmatizes these activists. It further renders their lives more precarious. It makes them even more vulnerable to all kinds of attacks. And in the end, analytically, I think it falls apart when you are attuned to issues of reinforcing Orientalism or reifying oppressive power structures and such as, for example, anti-women and misogynist currents. So I explicate this quite carefully and deliberately, and also draw upon other scholars who have raised these concerns, and I really try to ground my analysis in their writings. And the notion of homonationalism, I mean, I think that it's brilliant, and I think that it is very much applicable to the Israeli state. It's very much applicable to the U.S. state, but when all of a sudden it was applied to the global queer Palestinian solidarity movement, I think that it went too far. And at that point, it revealed to me very clearly how that kind of discursive turn was less about actual solidarity or any kind of productive, constructive engagement with the movement, because not a single form of evidence was marshaled at all. But what it does is it actually ends up ultimately being about expanding the theoretical frontiers of a framework of a Western-based academic. That becomes the means and the end and the ultimate objective. And as a result, a kind of epistemic violence ensues. And so I hope that my chapter on academia is an invitation to Western-based academics to really rethink how it is that we engage with these kinds of social movements, and to try to truly reposition our work and our analysis in a way that embodies solidarity.
So, yeah, I agree. And I think up front, you did an excellent job speaking back to two influential ideas. And one of the passages that really struck me, I want to just read briefly for our listeners. You were quoting one of your interlocutors, who identifies as a lesbian and as a Palestinian living in the West Bank. And you quote her as saying, Zionists tell me that Palestinian is a social construct, and Mossadists, or those who sort of follow Joseph Mossad's idea of the gay international, tell me that LGBTQ is a social construction, or whatever you call it. Honestly, I don't care where these terms come from. All I know is that these words feel right. They are me, and this doesn't make me any less of a Palestinian. And so I was moved by that. At the same time, to defend either of the ideas, but you note in your book that, the critique that Mossad makes about sort of hegemonizing discourses, right? This idea that there is sort of only one way to be gay and it's a sort of Western way, is something to sort of keep in mind when one is thinking about different LGBTQ subjectivities. And with homonationalism, right, this idea that nations see themselves as civilized and they sort of measure their civilization based on how they treat LGBTQ communities, that there's something to critique, right, in both of these Western rights discourses, often very cynically deployed. So how do you balance, on the one hand, critiquing things that deserve criticism without, creating this sort of stifling empire of critique that erases the people like your interviewee?
Yeah, it's
a tough question.
So as a Palestinian, I personally believe that in the future we need to have one state. We need to have a binational, secular, democratic state,
yeah,
which Israelis and Palestinians. Palestinians live together with equality and with dignity. In the U.S. context, when I articulate that, it's tremendously controversial. It's considered super radical in so many spaces. And then all of a sudden, I'm met with this hysteria of people who say, you're genocidal. You want to drive all the Israelis into the sea. You want to destroy the Jewish state, except, I mean, and I'm, where are you getting this from? I'm articulating a vision for secularism, and I'm articulating a vision for democracy, and this should actually resonate according to at least purported American political values, etc. But it becomes so controversial, even though the argument I'm making is actually quite simple, quite reasonable, and is not inflammatory in any way, and is inclusive, etc. Similarly, I believe that LGBTQ people deserve equal rights. I believe that queer people in Palestine, in the US, all around the world, have the right to lead lives with dignity. We have the right not to experience structural homophobia, not to experience silencing of our voices, not to experience physical violence, not to experience familial homophobia, being disowned by our families, being rejected by our nations and our national projects, etc., etc., etc. And I believe that the struggle against homophobia is equally important to all other struggles against systems of oppression. Now, when I say this in a Middle Eastern or a Middle Eastern studies context, similarly, the parallel here is that is considered controversial. That argument that I'm making is considered very sensitive, is considered inflammatory, and then all of a sudden, all of these accusations of complicity and imperialism, I mean, these are harsh critiques, all of a sudden get thrown my way. How on earth did we get to that point? How did we get to that point where the basic argument that queer people in the Middle East deserve not to be met with different forms of violence and deserve to lead lives of dignity? How is it that we've come to a point that merely articulating that argument has to be so contentious? And my view is that we have enough is enough. You know, the recycling the same arguments that, well, you're talking about queerness and LGBTQ and these are Western categories and we have to look at their etymologies and we have to examine imperialist dynamics. I mean, these arguments have been made over and over and over and over and over. And they've been made over the past 20 years. We have to keep going back to them. But through my book, I'm inviting us to actually open a new chapter. Okay, we've made those arguments. We understand those concerns. But can we now go back to talking about homophobia? Can we now go back to talking about queer bodies on the ground? Because I think that what these intellectual discussions are doing is that they keep taking us away from going back to the empirical realities on the ground and actually listening and hearing the cries and the struggles of queer people who are actually suffering and who are in their local context doing what they can to ameliorate that suffering for themselves and for their counterparts. And rather than being met with our admiration, with our support, with our respect, Western-based academics are accusing those people of being quote-unquote local informants or native informants for the gay international agenda. So actually they're being re-victimized. They're being further blamed for their own oppression, even as they try to create better conditions for themselves so that they could lead lives that are true to themselves and that are free from these forms of violence. So I'm, to be honest, it's exhausting. I'm really, really exhausted. And I really, really hope that we can get to a point where young scholars, I'm a junior scholar myself, we can talk about queerness in the Middle East, queerness in the Arab world, and not have to constantly refer back to the same theoretical framework over and over that we've done and redone for 20 years. You know, so I really, really do hope that more people will have the courage to help us open a new chapter in scholarship on queerness in the MENA region.
You know, one of the many things that you wrote in the book that really resonated with me in the context of this discussion was Just a very simple rhetorical question, but I think it really is quite profound and important to keep in mind. And you write, to whom are academics accountable when they level such critiques? And, you know, I mean, you can, whether you're talking about critiques or really, frankly, any form of scholarship, it's something that I certainly try to think of myself. And I think it's an important question to continue raising, regardless of one's positionality or research topic, right? To whom are you responsible, or to whom are you accountable? And with that in mind, I just want to end by turning to your conclusion, in which you suggest that there is a potential for a queer Palestinian movement to radically reimagine possible futures without any sort of ideological purism. What does this look like for you? What do you hope to see going forward?
Thank you for that beautiful concluding question, and thank you for hitting the nail on the head, which is that my argument shouldn't be misconstrued as one against radical thinking and radical envisioning and radical movement building. I think that as a queer Palestinian, my existence is a radical act, and my vision and articulation for equality and to be able to lead a life of dignity as a subject in Palestine, in the US, in the world, is very, very much a radical act. But my concern is that we see radicalism moving in the direction of purity, right? And these radical purists, and that we cannot allow radicalism to only be legible as a purist endeavor. And so in the future, my hope is that the LGBTQ Palestinian movement, particularly its leadership, will be willing to embrace, as I mentioned, heterogeneity, democratization, and really opening its ranks to especially young queer Palestinians who have many, many different voices and who see things differently than some of the older generations do. And also that we do a better job at connecting queer Palestinians who live in Israel proper with those who live in the Gaza Strip and those who live in Jerusalem, those who live in the West Bank, as well as those who live in the diaspora. All of these political and geographic divides are products of Israeli colonial processes. And when we further reify these divides, we are playing into that project. And so I think in the future, it would be, you know, wonderful to see. And I do think we can get to this point where we can have a movement that's truly, truly inclusive. And it will be even much more powerful. This movement has faced these challenges, but it's also had tremendous success, as I really point out in the book. And I give many examples for some almost miracles that this movement has been able to pull off. But it has so much more potential, and it has so much more work to do. And I believe that we can get there. But I believe that we need more voices basically calling for this pluralism of thought and of practice. And I'm hopeful that we can move in that direction.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your conversation here with us. And usually we like to end the show by asking authors, what are you working on next? So now, what sort of projects are on your horizon?
Thank you. I've just started a new project with a colleague, Philip Ayoub, who's also a queer Palestinian academic in the U.S. We are working on studying LGBTQ movements across the Middle East, North Africa region, and thinking about the regional networks and transnational networks that connect them. So while this book that we've just talked about now specifically is on the LGBTQ Palestinian movement, I hope that my next queer book will actually look at region-wide movements across the MENA region.
Excellent. Well, thank you so very much for taking the time to talk with me today and to speak with our listeners. In the midst of a global pandemic and unrest and tremendously difficult situations, certainly in the United States, but of course also in Palestine, I just wanted to express to all of our listeners that we hope that you stay safe and wish you well in this very difficult time. Thanks so much for listening.